Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's June 24th, 55 degrees here in Old Town Park City and clouds. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, we have meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning.
And good morning to you, and happy Thursday or happy Friday Eve. Today's going to be a little bit different than yesterday. I already have a decent amount of cloud coverage around Park City, and we've also seen a couple of passing showers here and there. And we're going to see a pretty decent chance for scattered showers and maybe a thunderstorm as we move through the rest of today. So temperatures right now sitting in the 50s, but temperatures will be climbing to the middle and upper 60s. So going to be a relatively cool day across Park City as well. The chance for showers and storms will start to decrease into tonight, but we'll still keep at least a chance for scattered showers and storms again into and through tonight. But with the chance for storms, with how dry things have been, there continues to be a fire risk, but the red flag warnings are mainly west of Park City today, and then in the dry slot, in the slot canyons, if anybody's going to go out hiking or something to that effect today, it's something you might want to take into consideration. There won't be as much moisture tomorrow, but we're still going to keep the chance for scattered showers and thunderstorms in the forecast. We're looking at a partly sunny sky for times that we don't find rain. Temperatures will be climbing into the lower and middle 70s, so tomorrow is going to be warmer after starting off in the 50s once again. And then that moisture just continues to dwindle as we move into the weekend, as it starts to move more away to the east middle 70s with about a slight, just with a slight chance for isolated showers, maybe a rumble of thunder in the afternoon. And then Saturday night temperatures will continue to be in the 50s. Then the temperatures will start to gradually increase by the end of the weekend into the early stages of next week. We should have a mostly sunny sky Sunday, mostly sunny sky on Monday, and temperatures will be in the lower middle 80s Monday afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, might be in the upper 80s by Wednesday.
Okay. Thanks, Thomas.
You're welcome.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Deer Valley Music Summit County member and Park City resident Roger Armstrong, expressing his concerns with the proposed toxic soils repository landfill there at Quinn's Junction. Then Deer Valley Music Festival principal conductor Connor Gray Covington with details on the Deer Valley Music Festival and the chamber orchestra concerts taking place this summer at St. Mary's Church. Finally, Woodward marketing and communications manager Anamika DeLabio has details on the summer season, as well as a look back at the COVID season and a look ahead to next winter. News time now, 8:09. Good morning. Well, Tuesday night's community panel about the proposed soils repository along State Route 248 drew a number of comments from the community questioning the health risk of a site inside Park City, and an impassioned rebuttal to the proposal from a city member of the Summit County Council. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Park City Municipal claims the city is exploring building a contaminated soil site inside city limits as a way to address the issue of widespread soil contamination throughout much of the city in a fiscally and environmentally responsible way. The contaminated soil found in Park City is the byproduct of the city's days as a mining town in the 19th and 20th centuries. According to the city's project summary, the site would be lined with an industrial plastic liner. Once built, it could house roughly 120,000 cubic yards of soil from the proposed Arts and Culture District, future city and resident projects, and the 35,000 cubic yards of soil already at the site. The city estimates the facility will only be operational for 7 to 10 years and will then be capped with fresh soil. During the meeting, Summit County Councilor and Park City resident Roger Armstrong spoke for nearly 20 minutes and called into question the project's motivations, timeline of events, and transparency.
The crux of the problem here is that the city is functioning as a developer. If this were the peg companies coming to the city saying, we want to dig up this soil and we'd like to bury it here in town, you say, haul it to Tooele. And you said, we're not taking commercial waste. This is only for Park Cities. So our moral issue of not trucking our dirt out, our moral issue of the tailpipes, is it really a moral issue if every other commercial developer from Deer Valley to Park City to enter to Park City Mountain Resort has to still truck it to Tooele?
Armstrong's comments came in response to Park City Councilor Steve Joyce, who was on Tuesday's panel and made the case that the current proposal is the best option the city has seen in decades.
This is the safest soil solution that the town has ever had. And so that's why, from a city council standpoint, we feel good about this. We need to dot all the I's, cross all the T's, hell yeah. But if you turn around and say, well, leave the dirt where it is, guess what? It's dirt that's leaching into your water system right now. But anyway, I think that's part of the reason that we're maybe less concerned is
Joyce clarified that soil leaching into Park City's ground and spring water is minimal in most cases, with the exception of the Spiro Tunnel. Currently, contaminated soil is trucked to a facility in Tooele County in the far western desert of Utah. The city estimates transportation savings in the neighborhood of $17 million if a site is constructed in Park City. Armstrong also argued the soils project is only being discussed because of the city's pending proposal for an arts and culture district. The district at the corner of Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive is within the city's soils ordinance boundary, and roughly 60,000 cubic yards of soil from the project is planned to be stored at the future facility. Park City Deputy City Manager David Everett said placing the blame on the arts and culture district is not accurate because the other half of the facility would be filled with soil from other sources.
The Gordo facility is one that is not about the arts and culture district per se. I know you said that. That's not necessarily an accurate way characterize this. We got 35,000 cubic yards on site that were always intended to be temporarily stored there, but while a permanent solution was found, and this is the proposed permanent solution, so that we're doing it, as the council member said, in a safe and responsible manner.
Armstrong disagreed and said if that was the city's true intention, there would have been more exploration of alternate options like soil separation and increased soil testing to determine whether or not the soil could even be stored at a site only intended for mine tailings, also known as bevel-exempt soil.
But you haven't done the work on that because it would take too long for you to start on the Arts and Culture District, and we'll circle all the way back around to it. This is about the Arts and Culture District. This is not about toxic soils. This is not about city projects.
Park City's application for the facility is pending approval by the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. The UDEQ has told KPCW they will not be releasing any public comment on the application until after Park City's 60-day outreach period ends in mid-July. Park City Municipal has additional community outreach events planned for June 25th and July 13th, prior to a public hearing on the project before the City Council on July 15th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, and as you just heard, one of those who spoke against this project of a soils repository there at Quinns Junction is Summit County Council member and Park City resident Roger Armstrong. He also served as a member of the city's Blue Ribbon Soils Commission that made recommendations to the City Council about this dirt in 2013. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you brought up a lot of issues in your nearly 20-minute commentary Tuesday. Do you feel like you were heard?
It felt like it was pushing upstream. I mean, I think David Everett kept trying to say, well, that's really enough from you. We've got to move on to other people. And I think that that's been part of this process. I think there's been some misleading statements coming from the city in their public outreach. And I think the city in other areas where they've met with public resistance, there's been a tendency to shut things down. I'm not sure you're aware of what happened with Angela Mosqueda during the Park City Council retreat, but apparently the mayor didn't like that she was addressing some comments made by Max Doyle, and he had just cut her off at some point. So they've got to be more open to public input, I think, and that's been part of the problem.
So, and I guess some would say, is that your biggest complaint? I mean, that the process and lack of public scrutiny, or is it that you just don't want an arts and culture, pay for an arts and culture district?
I honestly do not care about an arts and culture district. If that's something that the city wants to pursue, that's outside of my pay grade. What I'm concerned about is the public process that hasn't been followed here. And I think to talk about that process, you've got to frame it properly. The city is a developer here. The city is not just a regulator. And if we take the city out of this, if I told you, hey, Leslie, you know what? There's a new law passed by the state legislature, and it's going to allow PEG companies to set their own standards and rules, and they can disclose whatever they want to the public, and we just have to live with it. So they're responsible for complying with their own rules that they get to set. That's what the city is doing here, and part of that is kind of frame that around the Arts and Culture District, which is something obviously extremely important to this council and mayor, and they're pushing ahead on this really quickly. Andy has told people at Park City Heights during their public discussion that they had three public hearings about this. They didn't. You and I know that they had three meetings. The first meeting was June 18th. 19th, 2020. It lasted for a total of 34 minutes. The only thing they really talked about was, at that meeting, was trying to get the DEQ permit, the suitability of Gordo for the soil storage, and really not much else. There was mention of dust by David Everett, the assistant city manager, and he said, you know, that's something to think about, and also this is right next to the Round Valley Trail system, and that's a beloved area, and that's something that we have to think about. Nan Worrell said, well, let's talk about the dust. Is that hazardous to health? Is that something that we need to worry about people being exposed to on the Round Valley Trails? David Everett said, I'll get back to you on that, and he didn't. The second meeting that they had in November, they had a staff report, but they didn't have one word of discussion about it. And the staff report was, again, just an update on the EPA process and kind of what they were going to be doing out there. The third meeting was February 25th. There was zero discussion at that meeting, not one word. And then Andy says, you know, we had all these meetings and the press didn't even take any interest. There was no discussion. There's never been one word of discussion about what is a bevel exemption. And yet council members are out there tossing it around like the public knows what it means. There's not been one discussion about the health issues. There's not been any discussions about what the content of the soil is at that arts and culture property. It's not just mine tailings. It was a mine tailings pond, but there was also a gas station there, and we know that those contain petroleum compounds and hydrocarbons, and those are cancer-causing. Mine waste itself is cancer-causing with barium and cadmium and certain other heavy metals. There was a railroad operation there. It was a turnaround for rail cars, and that can lead to toluene problems from the rail system. There was a ramp where they unloaded stuff onto these rail cars at that same property. There was material storage there. There's been a whole host of uses, and the testing at that property has been extremely limited, and they have not shown the public or DEQ or anybody else comprehensive testing of that 5 acres to show that it is all bevel exempt material. If you mix other hazardous waste with bevel-exempt waste, it totally negates the exemption, and it all becomes toxic, and it all has to be treated at a high level of toxicity and disposed of elsewhere. So they don't know what's there. They haven't tested enough to know what's there. And then you've got Andy saying things like, this is not toxic material. It's not like it's radioactive waste. I love this quote, despite all the alertism, they are not hazardous. They are not toxic. And yet then you've got their water manager, their water consultant, Bill Laughlin, saying, we've got to get that stuff out of there because it's near our 3 wells, and we don't want our wells contaminated with these toxic materials. I don't know how you have it's not toxic. Steve Joyce telling me it's not toxic. You keep tossing that out. And their water consultant saying, we got to get this out of here because it's toxic. It makes no sense.
So you're telling me then the proposed repository that Park City wants to build would not be able to take some of the other soils other than the mine tailings?
That's correct. The bevel-exempt waste can go there. The other stuff cannot go there. The only thing that DEQ has said to the city made an argument starting back in 2019 with a letter to DEQ that said, we think that this qualifies as bevel-exempt waste because it's mine waste. The DEQ responded with a letter that said, if you're right, if it's really bevel-exempt stuff, yeah, you can put it there. And then they followed up. The city had that June 20th meeting a year ago, the only time they talked about it, for 34 minutes. And the next day, they sent a letter to the DEQ saying, would it be okay? We're not sure what our timeline is to start excavating this material. Would it be okay with you if we just started excavating it whenever and hauled it out to Gordo and just piled it up there without any liner until we finally figure out when we get your approval and we can proceed with a lined cell? And the DEQ a month later in July said, go ahead.
Well, you say no testing has been done. The former property owner, though, Mark Fisher, did do some testing, and what he found there was that there is a lot of clean dirt, and which is why he asked back in 2013 that the Soils Commission look at some sort of segregation policy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of clean dirt. There's likely a lot of clean dirt. I don't want to say there is a lot of anything. If they're talking about 60,000 cubic yards of dirt, that's about 90 tons of dirt. So it's a fair amount of dirt. There's still going to be toxins in there. Some of it is likely Bevel exempt. Most of it is likely Bevel exempt, but we don't know that all of it is. And the numbers that came out of there are actually a bit surprising in terms of the levels of lead. You'll recall when we were on this, you were on the Soils Commission with me, and we were asked to make a decision or help the city make a decision. The EPA formerly had a limit of 200 milligrams per kilograms of lead. EPA had raised it to 400. The city soil ordinance is 200. There's 3,800 milligrams per kilogram in some parts of that property, 2,400 in others. It's multiple times the allowable limit. Some of that does get examined under the background of surrounding properties and what's in the natural environment, because again, we've got lead and arsenic in this environment. But again, if you've done 11 punches out there, which is, I think, what they did for the Terracon study in 2017, you can't know comprehensively what's on that property.
All right. So we can do testing, and my guess is that the city of Park City would not be against getting rid of the really bad stuff and taking it to where it needs to be. So we still need to talk about the mine tailings, and I guess... Do I hear you saying it's like you don't want to get rid of this stuff?
I'd like them to follow, frankly, the Soils Commission recommendation. And our number one recommendation, and we highlighted that by saying the most important thing we think you should do is come up with a segregation plan. And that's what Mark Fisher came to us and said. He said there's plenty of clean dirt there. If I could only just haul away the toxic dirt, then we'd be good. I could actually afford to do projects and redevelop Bonanza Park and make it look a lot better than it is. And so we evaluated that, and we recommend to the mayor, Dana Williams at the time, and the city council at the time, develop a segregation plan, implement it, test it, make sure it works. And if it works, only then should you consider a soils repository. And even then, we recommend that you don't do that. It should only be for non-hazardous dirt. And we recommend that you don't do it because of the cost of doing it and because of the public issues associated with that. We heard from Park City's current advisor, Brett Mickelson, that when Cache Valley went to put in a landfill there, it took 10 years to get approvals because the public process was so rigorous and complicated. Ralph Bone at DEQ told us that he knew of another instance where it took 2 decades to get the approval. This is about the Arts and Culture District. This is about being able to break ground as soon as possible. And the sad part of it is that the city's done 2 things. There's dirt being moved out there now. So that cap has been broken, and that lead in that soil, much of it is within the first foot or so of the surface, according to part of the Terracon report. And that's open to the public now. And I guess the second part of that are the health aspects have not been discussed at all. No evidence the city has been briefed about lead dust, the contamination, what happens to it. There has not been a single public discussion.
All right. And I want to get back to that really quickly, but in 2013, as a member of the commission, you heard from an excavation contractor that there is contaminated soil everywhere in town. We're not just talking Prospect or Bonanza. We've seen this toxic soil cleaned up from the Montage to the Park City School District, across Kearns Boulevard to Park Meadows. I mean, in 2013, it's been found in Thames Canyon. I mean, in 2013, you heard from those living in Prospector that residents can't build a fence, can't safely plant a tree because if a hole is dug, the tailings are found. So where do they put the dirt? If there is not some sort of safe disposal area, forget the Arts and Culture District. I mean, we've got residents that are just going to throw the tainted dirt in the trash, and that's going to go to the county landfill, no?
I get it. I mean, you know, the residents in Prospector are living on technically a Superfund site. It was on the way to being classified as a Superfund site, and that got taken away through negotiation. And I suspect a lot of that was political. There were houses built there. I can't imagine how you handle that remediation had they gone forward with that. So the compromise worked out was stay there, but you're going to have to keep your soils capped. And that's what I'm saying, is that that's no longer capped. Would this be a benefit to residents? Sure. But we're not talking about, you know, 5 or 10,000 cubic yards of residential waste. We're talking about upwards of 140,000 cubic yards, which is 210,000 tons of toxic waste being buried within our city limits. I don't understand that. Right now, it has to be taken away to Tooele. Not even Tooele. We keep saying it's Tooele. It's actually way west of Tooele, out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. I guess, though, since Park City is locked out of the Richardson Flat Soils Repository, doesn't it make fiscal sense for the city to have one of its own? I mean, you're a Park City taxpayer.
I am a Park City taxpayer. Does it make sense to have one of its own? Yeah, that may be expedient, but I don't think that that's... Here's the way I look at what we do at the city, county, state, and federal level. If you're part of the government, your first job foremost is the health, safety, and welfare of the people. Number one, that's what zoning is about. That's what everything we do should be about, health, safety, and welfare. So if we take those first two steps, health and safety, is it better to have that stuff stored here? If they're wrong, by the way, if this is Bevel exemption, let me give you a weird, you know, here's the paranoid lawyer scenario. You've got a $16 an hour, $20 an hour guy overseeing the site, this Gordo site. After the while the toxic waste is being placed there, the site is open. We know that there's illegal dumping happening here in the county. We know that people are taking loads out to Browns Canyon, and we've alerted the DEQ, and they're looking into some of the dumping out there. Middle of the night, this $16, $20 an hour worker gets approached by a developer or by a transportation company who says, I can give you $50,000 if you let me bring in two trucks when nobody's looking. Just leave the gate unlocked. Nobody will know. And he dumps some stuff in there that's not Bevel exempt. And that's found out later. It's tested and found out to be toxic. Everything in that landfill has to come out and has to go to a higher level repository out in Tooele or someplace else. It can't stay here. The criteria to manage that particular repository is highly technical, and you got to get it right. As Rory Murphy said on Tuesday night, if you get it wrong, you buy the entire thing. It's a discharge, and you cannot discharge waste into the environment. One of the most disturbing things that I learned is in order to get this permit through DEQ, you've got to show 1,000-foot distances from recreation, from water, from residential areas. It turns out this Silver Creek is not 1,000 feet or farther away from this repository. It's about 500 feet away. And the city went to DEQ and petitioned them for a waiver so that they could place this closer to Silver Creek. And the argument was, it's already really contaminated, and therefore it's okay to do it. The deal we made with the EPA on the Gilmore parcel is once that's cleaned up, the wildlife and fisheries people want to come in and totally renovate and restore that stream to a first-class stream. And we're talking about, let's just go ahead and... It's not much of a risk. If junk goes in there, it's already dirty. I'm not sure that's where... And my last point, and then I'll shut up. My last point is their dust mitigation revolves around water. So we're going to water a 5-acre site of toxic dirt, and we're going to water a 6-acre site of a repository for up to 10 years to keep the dust down. Is that really what we want to be doing with water in the kind of drought that we have today? Is that a good use of resource?
So the tainted soil that's already been stored at the Gordo property now for years, I mean, are we aware of if it's caused any problems?
It's sitting in an unlined hole, and it was sitting above that hole for a period of time and blowing. I don't know what's in it. I assume they've tested it. They haven't disclosed that any place that I've seen. I don't know what's there.
So, I mean, why not support something that would be even safer than what we've got?
It's not even safer to put more there. If you're telling me, should we bury the 35,000 cubic yards there? If somebody can tell me that that's been tested and that it's all Bevel exempt and it's a low level of waste, sure. If they haven't done that testing, they literally do not understand what Bevel exempt means. If they're saying it's not, the EPA has said just because we categorize something as Bevel excluded. And in the law, we say, therefore, we won't categorize it as hazardous. Doesn't mean it's not hazardous and toxic. It's still toxic to people, and it still has to be handled carefully.
So what is the liability of holding Bevel-exempt soil? That was something that you had argued.
During the time that it's open, you've got to make sure that nothing else goes in there. They've said in their plan that they're going to monitor it constantly. They're going to make sure nothing else goes in. If it does, they'll close it down, make people clean it out. But my fear is that if it's toxic material that's not Bevel-exempt material, once it's in there, you can't unwind it. It's contaminated, and it's all got to be hauled out.
All right. So, again, are you making the argument that this is just the wrong location and that the city just needs to find a new location for putting some Bevel-exempt soil in it? Or are you saying, you know what, everything that is found toxic, we haul to Tula?
Well,
and again, that doesn't address the people in Prospect who are building a new fence.
I'll tell you, that would be my first choice, but it comes with a big caveat. There hasn't been a process on this at all. Three meetings, 34 minutes of discussion. Nothing else has been told to the public, and frankly, of greater concern to me is I don't see the presentations to the city council. I don't see the city council getting presentations on health. I don't see them getting, and I'm not talking about a three-page report like the Park Record reported from a law firm, which supports exactly what I just said. If you don't handle this right, you bit off a big problem. Health issues, regulatory issues, what happens if you fail? How do you have to handle this stuff? None of those hearings have taken place at all. This has been fast-tracked from the beginning. You asked Andy on April 30th after this robocall happened. You said, Andy, so what? This is a done deal, right? You guys are just going to do this. And Andy said, well, yeah. I mean, you know, we're waiting to see what the EPA says, but it's looking pretty positive. And, you know, once the EPA gets all the public comment in, they'll formalize it. And, yeah, we're going to go forward. And now he and Tim and others are saying, well, we were just waiting to this part of the process to engage you as the public. We didn't have any intention. They intended to install the liner, they have said, in July, and they were going to start moving soil in August of this year. And the bell got rung, and suddenly they stepped back and went, uh-oh, maybe we need a process for this. And I have no idea how we got here. That's my greatest wish. Let's talk about it. Tell us what you want to do. Tell us why you want to do it. And tell us what the risks are. And let us help you make a decision as the public. That's the important part.
Okay. Roger, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, Connor Gray Covington is the Utah Symphony's associate conductor, also principal conductor of the Deer Valley Music Festival. This summer, he'll be conducting 10 of the festival's 14 concerts, including the Patriotic Pops, the Beach Boys, the 1812 Overture, and three concerts at St. Mary's Church. He joins me now in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So when does the festival kick off?
So it officially kicks off July 2nd, next Friday, with our Patriotic Pops concert with our wonderful Broadway star and festival favorite, Kapathia Jenkins.
Okay. And we've got then another 13 shows then?
Yes, that's correct. And we are reducing capacity just slightly to 70% at the Deer Valley, at the Snow Park Amphitheater. So people will be able to spread out just a little bit. But because of that slightly reduced capacity, we already have several concerts that are sold out. Both of the Beach Boys performances are sold out. I know the Temptations are sold out. I think Cool and the Gang might be as well. But we also have several that are still available, including Kristen Chenoweth and the Little River Band, and also one of my personal favorites, our annual 1812 concert with Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto.
Okay, will you be conducting that one?
Yes.
Yeah, with the canons?
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Very nice. Okay. Let's see, there are a couple of locations just that we're talking about, both the Deer Valley Snow Park Amphitheater mm-hmm. and St. Mary's Church?
And St. Mary's Church, yeah. So on Wednesday evenings, we have chamber orchestra concerts in St. Mary's Church, which is just such a spectacular venue to hear music in. And we're featuring, on each concert, we're featuring a principal musician from the orchestra playing a concerto. So we're doing the Mozart D major flute concerto with our principal flute, Mercedes Smith, the Haydn C major cello concerto with principal cello, Matt Johnson, and a concerto by a relatively unknown composer who I just discovered last year. His name is Joseph Boulogne, Chevalier de St. George. We are doing his one of his violin concertos with a good friend of mine and associate concertmaster, Catherine Eberle.
Okay. Are those, who chooses those?
I chose those.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Okay. Yeah. So the St. Mary's concerts, then, they're all happening in July. We've got one on the 14th, one on the 21st, and then again on the 28th. When do those start?
In terms of what time?
Yeah.
I think they're usually 7:30. It's 8. I think those are usually 8. It's 7:30 or 8, but I'm pretty sure it's 8 o'clock.
Okay. Yeah. And then we've got tickets then to all three of those?
To all of those, yeah. And I think things have still kind of been changing, but last I heard, we've reduced capacity to those to about half, I think. But the orchestra will be slightly more spread out, and so we're actually doing some different works that we might not normally do, some slightly smaller things with, you know, a lot of string orchestra repertoire, but then also we're doing the Dvorak D minor wind serenade, which is a really fantastic piece, and I'm really excited about that one.
All right. So in terms of what the symphony's been up to over the last 15 months, just practicing?
No, we've been performing a lot, actually. We, you know, last summer we weren't able to do the festival at all, but during the summer we were coming up with protocols, and we actually had an airflow study commissioned in Abravanel Hall in our home in downtown Salt Lake from some engineers at the University of Utah, and they kind of gave us best practices. So this past season, everybody who was masked, everyone was distanced at least 6 feet. If you were a wind player, it was 10 feet. Obviously the wind players couldn't be masked, but they had the extra distance. So, you know, but all the string players, all the percussionists, pianists had masks. And we also did a lot of streaming. There was a period of in there where we weren't allowed to have any audiences. I think it was basically from around Thanksgiving through the end of March, actually. But we learned a lot. We basically kind of became a media company for a little while. We did a lot of streaming concerts. We were able to actually explore a lot of new repertoire that we wouldn't necessarily be playing. So that was actually really exciting for us. And I think, you know, obviously the pandemic has been really hard on everyone, but I feel like we did learn some good things in the pandemic about, you know, more efficient ways to do things. We have a new app now to where you can have your tickets on your phone, which is fantastic. I mean, I've been doing that for years with plane tickets. Then you don't have to worry about printing off anything. I think we pivoted pretty well, all things considered. We were in a lot better shape than a lot of other orchestras around the country.
Okay, so again, some of the tickets that are still available for those shows at Deer Valley Resort, we've got a week from tomorrow, the Patriotic Pops, then on the 10th, Kristen Chenoweth, on the 23rd, the Magical Music of Harry Potter, on the 30th of September, Little River Band, and then the 1812 Overture on July 31st. Tickets were sold, as you mentioned, for last year's show that then got canceled. If people held on to their tickets, they're still good.
Yeah, as far as I know, basically those have just kind of been transferred to this year, and you can kind of choose where you want to use those tickets. But our ticket office has been working really, really hard with patrons who had tickets for last year to figure out the best options for them this year.
Yeah. And how do people then get tickets then for some of the shows that haven't been sold out?
So you can go to Deer Valley Music Festival.org or UtahSymphony.org. Those will kind of channel you to the right places. And we do still have a lot of great shows that are available. And we had our first kind of semi-normal concert the other day outside in Draper, and it was so fantastic to see faces and, you know, have more musicians on stage, and which allowed, you know, a lot of bigger repertoire. So it was really wonderful, and the audience was super enthusiastic.
Yeah, and people should have a look there at usuo.org, because you've got concerts in Taylorsville, West Valley City, Gallivan Center. So it sounds like
we have
the summer.
Yeah, we have a lot along the Wasatch Front. We have a concert tonight in Taylorsville, and then several in the Gallivan Center, and like I said, all over the Wasatch Front, and then when the festival starts, it's pretty much all up here.
All right, and then I should think we should also note that you are offering some discounted youth tickets.
Yeah, I think for some of our shows, particularly what might be of interest is the magical music of Harry Potter. So that's some of the best film scoring, I think. And, you know, John Williams, who's undoubtedly the greatest film composer of all time, did the first, I think, 3 or 4 Harry Potter movies, the scores for those. And even the scores for the rest of the movies are really fantastic. So that's a really particularly good show for kids.
Okay. Just $15. Again, people can get more information at DeerValleyMusicFestival.org. And, again, some shows still available. Anything else you wanted to mention, Connor?
I don't think so, but just that we are really excited to be back. I know there's a lot of pent-up demand, but there's also a lot of pent-up energy in the orchestra to get out and play. So we're thrilled to be back.
Okay. Glad to have you back. Connor, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Connor Gray Covington, the Deer Valley Music Festival principal conductor. Well, summer's on at Utah's newest resort, Woodward. In the studio with details, I have the marketing and communications manager for Woodward, and Anamika DeLabio. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing, Leslie?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being here. So instead of half pipes, you've got dirt parks for mountain biking. Tell us what's happening at Woodward this summer.
Oh, lots of fun things this summer. So we have just kind of begun opening our mountain bike trails. We're kind of doing a phased opening of these trails. So right now we're working on rolling out new trails weekly. We do have a few new offerings this summer. So we have some additional progression trails, and those really focus on kind of building foundational skills if you're new to the sport or if you just want a refresher. So with those, we'll have a couple new modifications to some of our on-mountain trails as well.
All right, so it's kind of interesting. You have what you call a start park, mm-hmm. then these progression series, and then you've got what you call free ride, technical trails, and jump trails?
Mm-hmm.
So what do those look like?
Yeah, so for us, you know, we have a smaller space to work with, and really what makes our trails unique is that we try and maximize the potential for each trail. So we really try and focus on multi-use trails that can be interpreted different ways based on your ability level or what style of riding you like. So we do have a pretty healthy mix of all style of trails. So whether, you know, you're into more technical trails or just more free ride, we definitely have a lot of options for you and a lot of terrain that is available for people of varying ability levels.
Okay, these are all lift served. Do you have any uphill courses?
No uphill courses, so it's all primarily lift served terrain. However, our start park area is within our base area, and some of our progression areas are going to be accessible within the base area as well.
Okay, and then you also have an outdoor pump track. What's that?
Yes, so we have a variety of outdoor action sports parks that we call them. It includes our outdoor pump track. So we cater to a variety of sports at Woodward, primarily a lot of wheeled action sports. So whether you're into scootering or skateboarding, you know, we have a variety of options for you, including that pump track and then our Central Plaza and W Plaza. So all of those can be utilized if you purchase tickets.
Okay, and it's not just outdoors. You got all of the indoors opening as well. What's that? What's in there?
Yes. So our indoor action sports hub is 66,000 square feet of awesomeness. It features an indoor concrete skate park. We have ramps. We have trampolines and foam pits. So we really cater to a wide variety of user. Even if you don't really have experience with an action sports, you can come and bounce on the trampolines for the day, or if you want to work on honing in a trick, we have some safe areas for you to do that.
All right. Coming up tomorrow, it looks like you've got what you're calling the Forever Friday, Play Forever Friday. What's that about?
Yes, so Play Forever is kind of our corporate responsibility of protecting the environment and enabling participation. So this summer, we're going to be rolling out a series of Play Forever Fridays. Those we will partner with a local nonprofit, and it's really kind of focused on highlighting that local nonprofit and sharing with the community what services they offer. So tomorrow we'll be kicking off our first one, and it's going to be with the Youth Sports Alliance, and $10 of each ticket that is purchased is going to go back towards YSA through the Park City Community Foundation. So it's really just a way for us to give back to the community and kind of spread awareness of the great local nonprofits that we work with and that are in town here.
Okay, and then starting July 2nd, you've got the Woodward Park City Race Series. Is that, again, a mountain bike series?
Yeah, so we've got a ton of really fun community events coming up this summer, and you know, we're really trying to focus on incorporating the community more and having a lot of really family-friendly events. So one of those is the Woodward Park City Race Series. It's basically going to be $10. You can race your friends. That $10 includes one Lyft ride up. So it'll be a great after-work event. Kicks off at 5 p.m. And we'll definitely have a lot of interest in that this summer. So if you're interested, we highly encourage you to get your tickets now.
Okay, so is it a timed event then? I mean, it's just top to bottom?
Top to bottom. We'll pick a different trail each race that we do. So there will be a series of 5 races this summer. So whether you just want to participate in one race, you can do that. Or if you want to be involved in all of them, you can be in the whole series.
All right. And then similar to winter, or is that what you're doing, kind of like the monthly or 3-month memberships? Or how's that working?
Yes. So we have a variety of access options. Currently, we offer memberships in either an all-access form or an outdoor form. So the all-access membership is a minimum 6-month commitment, and then it's a reoccurring monthly after that, but that gets you access to all of our facilities. And then the outdoor membership is really just focused on the lift serve terrain and the outdoor action sports park. So with that, you only are required to do a 3-month minimum commitment and can continue on from there. So that one's kind of a good seasonal option if, you know, you're only into mountain biking or you're only into skiing and snowboarding. We have a variety of options for that, as well as daily access as well.
Okay. And do people still need to make that reservation for the daily access?
Yeah, we highly encourage it. It's definitely more guaranteed to reserve your spot. We have summer camp programs going on right now throughout the week. So lots of buzz happening around our campus. And so if you want to come and enjoy a session, we definitely encourage you to book online in advance, but you can still do walk up as well.
Okay. So the camps are usually what, like a week long, and then otherwise it just, you would get maybe a daily lesson? That's the difference between
yes,
them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're doing 10 weeks of summer camp this year, and that caters to a variety of sports: skateboard, scooter, BMX, mountain bike, parkour, cheerleading, and multi-sport. And those run Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. So with that, we kind of have a mix of activity and instruction for the kids. It's for children ages 7 through 17. So it's kind of a really awesome option for kids to come out and just enjoy the facilities that we have. It's also a great option for them to escape the heat this summer, because we offer a mix between outdoor and indoor instruction. And so it, you know, keeps them active, but also gives them a good variety of things to do.
All right. Any COVID precautions that are part of the summer?
Yes. So we do still require masks indoors. I think we're probably one of the few places that are still requiring that around here. But with summer camps going on, we just want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence to protect our guests and our staff. And with that, we are our session times currently for indoors are 1 hour and 45 minutes. So that allows us for a 15-minute cleaning in between sessions. Outdoors, you're required to wear masks if you can't maintain 6 feet of distance. So we still have, you know, quite a few protocols in place, and we're just monitoring that weekly.
All right. So what kind of winter did Woodward have, given the pandemic? When I drove by, it looked like the parking lot was always full.
Yeah, we honestly, all things considered, had a pretty amazing winter. You know, we had 179 days on snow, which is quite the achievement for a new facility. I think that actually put us at the longest season in Utah, which is pretty awesome. And, you know, we offered a mix of activities for guests and members alike. So we had our tubing hill, which was a huge hit. You know, our mountain park, which saw regular usage. We offered lessons and instruction all winter as well. And then the indoor action sports hub was always busy as well. So we had a really great winter and are just so thankful for, you know, the staff and the community that we have, and are hoping to kind of continue that throughout the summer.
Okay. You got anything new planned for the upcoming winter, or are you basically built out?
We're kind of in full summer mode right now. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we're always looking for opportunities to expand and improve our product. And I think as we approach the winter, we'll kind of look at other ways that we can do so. But for right now, you know, our main focus is on summer and for just bringing new events and fostering community and just having a great product for people that are coming out here.
Okay, great. People can get more information, woodwardparkcity.com. Anything else you want to mention?
There's one last thing I do want to mention, and that will coincide with our race series is First Fridays. So that's going to be a really fun event, and that is going to be free to vendors and to guests to participate. So we're focusing on local vendors. If anyone's interested, feel free to look us up at woodwardparkcity.com, and you can find out more information.
Okay, Mika, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox will be congratulating Park City athlete and mother of seven, Jen Drummond, for her example, tenacity, and determination to set a goal to become the first woman ever to climb and summit the so-called Second Seven. This is the second highest mountains on each of the world's seven continents. Drummond has summited three of the seven, including Mount Everest, earlier this month. Congratulations. Governor Cox will be wishing her success in achieving her remarkable and ambitious goal in a ceremony today in the Gold Room on the second floor of the Utah State Capitol at 1 p.m. Way to go, Jen. Well, Summit County is strengthening its resource to combat and treat child abuse. KPCW's Jessica Lowell went to the ribbon cutting of the Children's Justice Center this week and has this report.
Private and public stakeholders celebrated the opening of the Children's Justice Center House, which will investigate child abuse claims. The center doesn't offer shelter for children, but it does offer support through therapy and classes for children and parents. Children's Justice Center Board President Harry Kirshner says the facility, which is in Silver Creek, offers a neutral environment.
So the whole idea behind the facility is it should be centrally located and accessible, but it should also feel private and comfortable. Like a home, because you have a child and family members coming to talk about abuse that has occurred to them. So you want them to feel obviously as relaxed as possible.
The nearly $1.8 million house was funded with money from the county and private donors. It was renovated for another $800,000 to meet ADA regulations for commercial buildings. It replaces the previous center, which was less than 1,000 square feet, in the basement of the Summit County Library.
And unfortunately, it both lacked the privacy and the space for the professionals to do their job of investigating child abuse and supporting families. But it also just wasn't large enough for the demand, unfortunately, of cases that they had to investigate in the community.
The new house has enough space for conference rooms, a small kitchen, as well as a medical suite. Christina Sally is the investigator for the Summit County Attorney's Office and a child forensic interviewer for the center. She says stakeholders didn't need any convincing to get on board with a dedicated, independent space for the center.
We've had tremendous support. I think it's taken a while to recognize that child abuse does happen in our community. Nobody wants to believe that. We live in a great spot. And so we were so fortunate to have a group of people who said, wow, we have this need in our community.
Kirshner says as the community has grown, incidents of abuse have also grown. New abuse cases have increased by about 10 to 20% each year since he started on the board 8 years ago.
Unfortunately, we kind of mirror the national averages. The statistics are pretty sombering. In the U.S., I think one in four girls and one in six boys will face abuse by the time they turn 18, either physical or sexual abuse.
And Sally says rates of abuse don't vary based on socioeconomic status, ethnicity, religion, or geography in the county.
It happens everywhere, and what our goal is to bring awareness to the issue so that we don't kind of sweep it under the carpet and say, well, geez, it's not my business that, you know, this family is having some issues and maybe I'm concerned about the children. We really have to be able to talk about that to keep the kids safe, because a lot of times they don't have their own voice or they're scared to talk about it.
She says there were more cases with the pandemic as children were left at home with their abusers and didn't have access to normal safe spaces like schools. And in Utah, there's a mandatory reporting requirement for abuse. Kirshner says people who don't report abuse are liable.
We want to get the word out a little bit more so that people know what to do if they suspect abuse and know that it's sort of right answer to come here, because that child, that family is going to be treated well, and will determine ultimately right what the path forward is for them.
The center had its ribbon cutting this week, but staff had been using the space since December. There'll be an open house for the public sometime in fall. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.